Hello and welcome to From the Trenches, brought to you by the American Thoracic Society and the Association of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Division Directors. I'm your host, Dr. Naftali Kaminsky, and I'm excited to have with us today a special guest, Jose Razumaya. He's the Open Endowed Chair and Chief of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine at the University of Southern Florida. Jose started his career in my lab, and I've been very proud of his achievements. So this is actually a really episode special, almost emotional episode for me. So welcome, Jose. Good to see you today. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Jose Razo. Is it okay that I call you Jose?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. And of course, you can call me Naftali if you had any doubt. As you know, this is actually one of our first recordings of the From the Trenches podcast that aims to demystify division chiefs and sort of help people see and understand and identify the sort of the people that they interact with them. Our tradition is we usually start with sort of an icebreaker, and I think we know each other pretty well. We collaborate a lot. We work together, but it's always good to start with something. And you're sort of well known in the pulmonary community, definitely in the research community. But it's always good to sort of start the discussion by telling people something that they don't know about you. So, are you willing to tell us a sort of an interesting fact that we don't know about you?
Yes, and this is something that actually quite embarrasses me, to be honest with you, is the fact that I'm pretty afraid of heights. So, and it's very noticeable, for example, when we go to amusement parks, because I don't do roller coasters, and if I do them, it's usually pushed by my wife. And when I do one, or the ones that I've done maybe twice or three times in my life, I usually close my eyes and clench my teeth, and so that's kind of my hidden fact that people don't know much about me. I'm very afraid of heights.
So that's one is I'm really, frankly, I'm really excited that you chose something that is not like superhuman. That you didn't tell us, oh, I like climbed the Tour Eiffel or something like this. But actually, so I really appreciate this. There is a tendency among leaders, especially in academia, to present their sort of their superpowers. And I'm one of these people that feel that actually some of our weaknesses and definitely our anxieties turned into our superpowers. So I'm really grateful. So actually tell me, well, why did you choose to mention this?
Well, I don't know, man. I think that it's funny. When I was a little kid, I always wanted to be a pilot, and my parents actually dissuaded me from that idea because they were concerned that I was gonna die in a in a plane accident. So, and instead they pushed me to, not push me, but like suggested the medical field and science, and actually they were right because I don't think I could have been a pilot being afraid of heights. So in a way, I think that sometimes the path takes you to where you need to be instead of where you want to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. Again, as somebody who whose life has been a little bit defined by anxiety, as you know, I have a severe flight anxiety, which it did affect my life. I feel that as leaders, recognizing sometimes a limitation is really important, because now when the person who comes into your office and say, I can't do this thing, I'm really worried about it, instead of just telling them you'll be okay, you can sometimes identify with them, listen, and then you tell them you'll be okay, right? And yeah, so in some ways, I think that this is, as I say, a superpower. So going back to actually being a chief, so think your background is a little bit different than many other sort of traditional chiefs in the U.S. and definitely
very different, if I would interject.
Yeah, and definitely very different than the previous generations of chiefs. Yeah. I'm really excited that now we have chiefs from multiple regions of the world and multiple backgrounds and others. But did you actually know you were going to be a chief?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I felt that at some point I was going to be a leader. I didn't know that, you know, leadership was going to be reflected in being, you know, division chief. And certainly not at my age, in my current state of life. You know, the opportunity presented and I thought that, you know, I could do it, and I said, let's do it. So.
But let's think about it a little bit slightly different. So I know, coming from a different country, I actually didn't know what is a chief, right? We had these department chairs that were professors forever. And so how did it actually occur to you? So was it in when you, I don't know, came to the immigration in the U.S. and you said, oh, I'm going to be a chief, and they looked at you and kicked you out? Or
no, it's, you know, a lot of things have happened in my life in some sort of a serendipitous way, right? So, you know, when I first came to this country as an international medical graduate,
I mentioned it in the introduction, but just to reiterate, where did you come from, and a little bit about
So I'm from Colombia, not Colombia, the University of Colombia, the country, which has been mistaken a couple times, and the city is Cartagena. So I went to medical school at University of Cartagena, which is one of the oldest medical schools in Colombia. But very early in my career, I knew that I needed a little bit more than just being a doctor. So I wanted to do science, and that's how I ended up in your lab. And I think that when I first immigrated to this country, I think my first goal was to A, learn science, and B, train in pulmonary critical care in one of the best places. And that's how I ended up at University of Pittsburgh. Never occurred to me so early in my career, I'm going to be a chief. I mean, I looked up to, you know, division leaders, you know, chiefs, you know, like Mark Gladwin, right? So that was a sort of a role model. And I said, wow, this guy's so good and you know, so energetic. And, you know, maybe I want to be like him one day, right? Or you, you know, for example. So I think that, you know, having those role models, you, Mark, David Wilkes, were people that at some point motivated me to, or role models that motivated me to pursue, you know, leadership roles in academic medicine. It never occurred to me until, you know, it just happened. I really thought, you know, that I needed to consolidate my scientific career before becoming a division chief. But, you know, sometimes the path just presents itself. It's difficult to try to follow a linear path because life throws you curveballs, right? And then so you have to adjust as you go. And but yeah, here I am.
Yeah, I think that that's a really common thing, that we don't really know what kind of roles. And when I reflect of sort of the promising physician scientists in Pittsburgh in 2003 or four. So myself, Allison Morris, Janet Lee, we're now chiefs, but it's not like we sat in a cafe on Forbes Avenue and said, oh, we're going to be chiefs one day.
Right? Yeah, we're
mostly worried about our next grant. And how to survive sort of the grind of work life and all other things that happen. So I think that's an important comment. So now you're a chief. How long have you been a chief now? It's a
I
it's months.
started April, April of last year. So close, close to a year.
So what does a chief do?
Oh man, I wear so many hats. I think it's funny. Someone asked the other day in a conference, and who is a system designer? And I raised my hand, and people looked at me like, "Is this guy crazy?" Because that's not traditionally what system designers do, right? They work in computers and designing, systems at the programmatic level. But a chief is a system designer in a way that we have to design coverage models. We have to build research and design the system to build research. And so I consider myself a system designer in a way that I'm constantly looking at models to staff my division, take care of patients, make sure the quality is always there, and at the same time, building the research enterprise that I was tasked to build. So, and then in addition to that, I spend a lot of time doing faculty coaching and mentoring, and I spend a lot of time doing that. And so I work for a state university, so recruitment, it takes several steps. So I do a lot of physician recruitment and retention too. So it's I'm very busy.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. So that's interesting. What you gave us is and in some ways, I think that's gonna be a theme and is emerging as a theme in this in this series is that the job of a chief is in some ways not well defined. And in the other way is actually dependent on your vision, right?
Right. And
So yeah.
also you get measured by multiple metrics, right? Right. So and you don't know sometimes what metric is more important, right? For example, is your productivity the metric, the productivity of your division, or is it the recruitment of talent the metric? Is it retention? Is it research, R1s? Is it papers? So I think that not only is not well defined, it's also that it's hard to understand really what the metric that th what's the most important metric.
I think that's I remember when people look at and I I'm always been interested in sort of college sports. And when you look at college coaches, they're many times evaluated by the championship, which is actually a really rare event if you think there's thousands and thousands. But I once had the opportunity to sit next to somebody who is actually a sports scout, not a coach. And I complained about the coach that will never get that university to the next step. And he said, "Are you crazy? They never had a scandal." And I sort of realized suddenly that what I looked as mediocre was actually a huge success because that university was able to sport play sports at the highest level, be competitive, but also maintained an amazing atmosphere with very few sort of infractions. And we know that that's an issue. So I think it's, yeah, we don't know what are the metrics, and maybe the metrics for us is
do all of it, which is actually really hard.
Yeah, exactly. And then I, you know, to me, actually the best metric is to make sure the faculty are happy and they come to work and you know they're happy with what they're doing and then they feel they're represented by their chief. Because you know being a chief is like being a coach, like you say, right? So and we coach the team and if the coach loses the team, then here comes the next coach, right? So I think that the most important role, at least to me, and again, I try not to care too much about what the other metrics are, is make sure that the team is happy and that they're performing at the highest level and to keep them motivated to perform at the highest level.
And so where did you learn this? Did you, are there chief courses?
I don't know. I didn't take any chief courses. I call you all the time every time I have problems. And I've learned a lot from your experiences. I lean on a lot of my, you know, chair and vice chair and I try to get as much feedback as possible from my faculty, from the people above me. But no, I mean, there's no, I don't think the book has ever been written. And I do think that, you know, it'll be valuable for you know, young chiefs to sort of have a mentorship program. Because like you said, it's not an easy job, right? And you know, we have to perform at the highest level, keep a lot of people happy, and you know, there's no training for it, right? It's like being a parent. No one really teaches you how to be a parent. So in a way, it'll be nice to have some sort of that mentorship program.
Yeah, so that's so are there like would you say that there are things that because we all sort of develop our style of leadership, right? And some of it is just natural, some of it is learned, some of it is mimicked. So is are there any things, let's say, not necessarily in medicine, but actually in your life background, in the family, in other things that sort of help guide you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think one of the things that I've learned very early on from my parents was, you know, to be fair, you know, and to be humble. And I think that those are kind of personality traits that are very helpful when you're a chief, because if your team perceives you as fair and as, you know, as someone who will take care of everyone the same way, the best you can, they will follow you. And I think that on the other hand, if you don't value the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you'll deem to fail. So, and I think that that was taught to me very early on in my life by my parents, and I think I try to apply that every day, and I think it's been very helpful.
Yeah, I think this is a weird discussion that I don't know if everybody have, because for me, both of my parents now are gone. But every now and then, something happens at work, or a mini crisis, or a deficit or whatever, and I sort of, and now my parents were really simple people, extremely smart, but never worked in an environment like we work, and definitely not physicians. So it would be hard for me to explain to them what is the problem. But sometimes it's like I feel, okay, if I could just tell them how I handled it, they would be very happy. And sometimes I cannot solve things the way that would make my parents happy. So, but I accept it. At least I remember, where I come from. But I think it's
Exactly.
a,
Yeah, and another thing that I try to do, which I learned from you, is I try, you know, when I face problems with faculty or the people that are under me, is I try not to think immediately, how can I get rid of this person, but how can I build this person to be better? And also, because, you know, I mean, behind the job that we do, everyone has a life, right? And sometimes people struggle with life. And, you know, you have to look at that humane aspect of your faculty and the people under you. And you have to understand what people go through sometimes. And you have to support them through those times. And they usually would appreciate, they appreciate that, right? And then, so they would be more motivated to work if you use a more humanistic approach rather than a punitive approach.
I think that that's a theme that also sort of starts emerging in this series, which is a lot of us use the approach of, instead of what's wrong, what's going on, right? So yeah, when there's a problem, you sit with a person and just ask him what's going on. And many times you learn things you frankly didn't want to learn, but every now and then you can help, right?
Correct.
And yeah, and then the team. So I think I can guess your next answer, but still, I think, you know, so what do you actually like about the job?
I even though I spend too much time doing coaching and I could use that time to, for example, do more science and writing, I actually enjoy that a lot. I mean, I enjoy spending time to faculty, talking to them, understand what they're going through, I don't necessarily call it mentorship, because, you know, coaching and mentorship are different, but, you know, talking to faculty and help them perform at their best is one of the things I enjoy the most. And, you know, obviously I have the fortune to have a lab and a team and do science. So, you know, it really excites me to do science. So that's actually one of my favorite things to do, is when I don't have to, when I can put my administrative work aside and then just focus on the science. I enjoyed that quite a lot.
So you'd say that it's sort of an interesting tension as a chief between the things that made you successful as an individual and the things that make you successful as part of leader of a team. But what's surprising is when you become a chief is that you start enjoying from the team things. It's almost there is a shift in your focus or the weight you put on things, and suddenly things that are important to other people, it's almost like you said, like being a parent, right? This transition from everything is about me to everything is about us.
Right.
I get that. And I think there is a tension, and there is a risk also that you may also forget about yourself. But I think sort of many of us can do both. Do you have, by now, this is a short time that you've been a chief, do you have any memorable moment in the last few months or anything? Or?
I mean, I think the most memorable moment for me was January 1st, which I implemented all the changes that I wanted to implement, which I think are going to make my division better. So, you know, January 1st was probably the most important day for me. Because, you know, I took the division in an atypical time, you know, in the spring, right? So, it's like, there's only so many changes you can make at a certain speed without creating chaos, right? So in the first few months, it's understanding, talking, listening, and try to slowly make changes. But I think, you know, the beginning of this year, I'm going to start seeing all the results of the things that I wanted to do. And also, I think that, you know, this time is very important to me, because I submitted NIH funding, so I'm hoping I can get a good score. So I think it's in the next couple of months, many good things are going to happen you know, at my division, which is, we'll see the results of the changes, and, you know, hopefully we can continue to grow.
So as a, again, as somebody who made the transition quite recently, and we touched on it a little bit. So do you think that, you know, the Association of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Division Chiefs was sort of created, started as grassroots and then created by the ATS probably 5 years ago to create this sort of division chief toolbox and support structure. So is there something that you would recommend for the leadership or of this organization that they could do to help chiefs in general? And
yeah, I mean, I think a mentorship program will be awesome, right? So if young chiefs can be paired with, you know, more experienced chiefs, that'll be very helpful. Because again, you know, we like we discussed before, there's no book, there's, you know, there's nothing's been written. So having someone that can, is willing to pick up the phone and listen in to you and provide some feedback and recommendations is helpful. I also think that perhaps, you know, kind of, you know, documenting what the priorities are in general, right? Because I think as an association, we need to look out for ourselves and understand what's really important when you're a chief. Is it productivity? Like I said, is it research? Is, you know, faculty recruitment and retention? And I mean, understand these priorities, it helps putting in perspective the work we do. So I think that those two things, I think, will be very valuable.
That's great. Yeah, I completely agree. I think when we started working on the handbook and actually published several papers to sort of the pandemic, like everybody else, sort of put us in a standstill. But I definitely think we should go back to working on the sort of the chief's playbook. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And okay, so, you know, we're winding down now. So I ask everybody the same question, to sort of finish. And so if you had the opportunity to go back in time and speak with your younger self as a resident or, you know, maybe a fellow, what advice would you give yourself?
That's a really tough question, because honestly, I personally wouldn't change anything about the life I've lived, in a sense of, you know, I remember when I was a resident, I think I spent more time in your lab and doing science than I spent taking care of patients. And I guess it was because, you know,
we shouldn't tell, this is a secret. Nobody should know. No, I'm just joking. Okay, go ahead.
No, and well, the reason is, you know, my medical training in Colombia was pretty strong. You know, I mean, we took care of so many patients that by the time, you know, I came to this country, I felt very comfortable taking care of patients. So I felt that I could spend more time doing research, and I still was a very good resident, you know. Actually was, I had awards yearly for the best resident, even though I spend more time doing research than I spend more time taking care of patients. So, you know, and I actually think that that's really what helped me to be where I am right now at my age. So I don't think, you know, a lot of times you answer this question by saying, well, you know, you should have given you the advice of work harder. I don't think I could have worked as hard as I did. I do think that one of the things that I could have done earlier was probably to have children. I mean, I think that, you know, I right now I have, you know, two little boys. So, you know, this job takes time away from them, right? So if I would have had kids at an earlier age, they will be a little older right now. And I could, you know, when you have little kids, you have to spend a lot of time taking care of them. So that's probably one of the things that it would have done a little bit different. But, you know, it's so hard, because when you see everything in retrospect, it's easier, right? So
you know, this is very interesting. And I'm gonna actually Yeah, potentially make this a little bit challenging. There's a whole discussion in the gender equity side, and mostly by actually prominent women physicians, that they regret not having a family or children earlier. This is an interesting question. So would you say that what you would tell to, let's say, your earliest version, like, med school and Columbia, is don't wait with your personal life? Would that be something?
I think so. I think so. And again, you have to remember that, I have a spouse, and also those decisions are shared decisions, right? But I think postponing life for academic success, it's probably a mistake. So, and I get it, taking care of kids, it's hard, and you spend a lot of time doing it, and you're probably not as productive as you should be. But at the end of the day, if you don't have a stable personal life, you're not going to be productive at the highest level anyways.
So,
So,
well, that I think that's a perfect message to end this, because I think, in some way what you're telling all of us is, regardless whether you want to have a family or you don't want to have a family, you want to have children, so, or you don't want to have a children, whatever your vision for your personal life is, don't postpone this decision until you finish your training. Use your early life, this precious decade between, I don't know, 24 to 35, to build the foundation of the rest of your life. Don't postpone things. And I think as leaders, that's a message we should give our trainees. Yeah, I think that's a great message. So
And as leaders, I think we also need to respect people that have families and responsibilities, right? And if they cannot show up to work because their kids are sick, I mean, we need to find a way to cover them rather than tell them, no, you need to show up to work, right? So I think that would have been the message that I would have given to myself, is don't postpone life, just do it in parallel and do the best you can.
okay. So thank you, Jose. This was I always have a great time speaking with you, and I always learn, so this was great. So thank you. Thank you, Jose, for joining us for today's episode, and also thank you on behalf of all of our listeners that enjoyed it. This episode of From the Trenches was brought to you by the American Thoracic Society and the Association of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Division Directors. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like, rate, review, or subscribe wherever you enjoy your podcast. Again, thanks for listening. And don't miss our next episode with the chief who became a dean, Mark Gladwin.